Yeah, so today I'm going to talk about bomber-dominated shocks and what we think are type 1A or type 1A-like supernova remnants. And I like to think of supernova remnants as the post-genitors of the supernova. They're post the supergenitors, yes, and generating my remnants, and generating my paycheck some days. So the type 1A supernova, the Bulmer filaments. First of all, I'm going to take a look at the remnants. Carlos has gone over some of this, but in what I'm looking at in the optical in the Bulmer lines, I'm seeing much more of the circumstellar interactions as well as the circumstellar structure. There's not a whole lot of ejecta information that you can glean from these. There is a section of S1006 that you kind of see ejecta poking out of one of these Bulmer filaments, but again, that's not going to tell you as much as you'd like, much more about the CSM or ISM in interactions and structures. Then going through the Bulmer line filaments, some modeling that I did, and that's going to really lead to some information about the CSM interactions, and then go through some observations and the analysis from that, which leads more to things about structure of the CSM and where this thing exploded. And then I'm going to talk about what we've gleaned from supernova remnants. So this is the basic supernova remnant structure. What Carlos was talking about was kind of all in here, and I'm talking about the forward shock, the compressed interstellar gas that has just been compressed or crushed by the forward shock, and I've covered up for type 1A, the compact object. The remnants, we have 256 known galactic supernova remnants, and they range from 300 to about 10,000 years old. There's 27 in the LMC and SMC, and compared with the number of supernovas found, that's a very little number. So in about 100 years, when these all becomes remnants, the supernova community will be the place to be. Now, just looking at your observations in general, is this is what you see in a supernova. You see this point of light compared to this these huge galaxies and things like this. But, you know, in supernova remnants, we get the beautiful pictures, the gratuitous Crab and Cassay, and then we have these who are type 1A-like, which Carlos went through. And then also to answer a question, that these all don't have to be spherical. They don't seem to have an overall property of sphericity, highly dependent on where they explode. So these are some remnants that show some obvious, non-sphericity. So why do I study supernova remnants? First of all, they're cosmic ray factories. They interact with the ISM in certain ways that we can hope can lead to understanding of the CSM. And then they also give us some clues about that structure more than just what's out there, and shock physics in general. So first of all, supernova remnants are supposed to be responsible for all this part of the cosmic ray production. Again, that's not something I'm really going to talk about, but there are models, Ellison and actually Patnaud are now working on models to understand how cosmic ray acceleration affects shocks and how close the ejecta can actually get to the shock based on how much compression you have from the cosmic from the energy released through cosmic ray acceleration. And in terms of now going to the ISM interactions and structures, you can start obtaining temperatures and densities from these studies. You can infer the structure of the ISM. How smooth is it? How turbulent is it? Did you have some place where there was a jet or a chimney? Do you have some place that is a lower density cavity? Those types of structures. You can also glean some magnetic field information from some of the shock physics. It's not absolute, and it's really hard to measure magnetic field as it is, but some of these models can imply something about the magnetic field that in the environment where these shocks are seen. And you can also play with waves and instabilities. So one of the questions that I asked myself when I first started thinking about this for this conference is, can we really see the CSM? Would we actually see this, or would it be already kind of equilibrated with the ISM before we get to observe it, before the remnant gets to it? So I took a single degenerate case that was recently talked about in the Woodvassy-Sokolowski paper, and they assume that they're creating this cavity with this type of radius, and I looked at just relaxing the medium and how long will it take for this wind in terms of temperature and density to kind of equilibrate to a mean ISM value. And it'll take about 10 to the 5 years. So we have to have a supernova explosion go off within about 40,000 years at the end of accretion, and then let the remnant evolve for about 100 years, and then there's a chance that we might see the CSM interactions from the remnant. So I think it's still possible. I'm not sure that that's what we see. We might just be seeing the ISM in most of these cases, but it does seem like a plausible argument that some of this can be CSM interactions. So now for the rest of the talk, what I'm going to talk about is the Balmer filaments, and this has to do with neutrals in at the shock front. And we use this because neutrals are a track of the pre-shock condition. So they can tell you what's going on in that ISM before the shock hits it. There's a possibility that they work as precursors in conjunction with cosmic ray acceleration. They help in interpretation of ion spectral lines. And just a point of interest, actually, is that in energetic neutral atoms in the magnetosphere of Jupiter seen by Cassini, they actually carry away a significant amount of energy and mass from the magnetosphere of planets. So that is something to keep in mind if we have any, say, heavy elements out in this ISM, because we could possibly be losing a lot of energy and energy and mass in those shocks. And there's also neutrals are in pickup ions. They come in through the heliosphere and they get accelerated. And so there's lots of reasons why you'd look at neutrals as a diagnostic. So these are the Balmer-dominated filaments, or two examples of them. There's one in Cygnus loop, and then this is actually a composite of a Hubble Balmer filament here, Hubble picture that's going to be recently published, and then the X-ray background for 1006. And so this is on the upper corner of 1006, and this is the filament that all the observations are based on. So in a Balmer-dominated filament, you have this narrow component, this large H-alpha feature, but it can't be fit by just one Gaussian. You need actually two. So here is just a blow-up of this region here, and you see that another Gaussian would fit down here, and then you'd have the strong narrow peak there. So it's different from your regular just broadening of a line. And why you get this broad and narrow component is not just due to thermal broadening or something like that. It's first of all, you just get the narrow component as you normally would in any atomic interaction. An upstream neutral is excited by a proton or electron and emits at its rest wavelength, so you get an H-alpha photon. But then the broad component has to be made up by two steps. So first of all, you take this downstream fast proton that comes in, and it charge transfers with just the slow ISM neutral that's sitting around. And they charge exchange, and so it now is neutral. It no longer has to worry about magnetic fields. It can just kind of shoot off by itself, but it's fast and it's neutral. And then the next step is that then that has to be excited by another proton, and it emits in the Doppler, at the Doppler shifted velocity of the fast neutral. So that's where you get the broadening in the base, and it's not as strong, obviously, as this. So here's the mandatory atomic physics that you have to understand in order to do this. You can see that there's a dependence on the charge exchange of the base, the charge exchange cross section times the velocity of the slow versus the ionization of the fast, and all that atomic physics. And it's actually really difficult physics to understand and to figure out which parameters to use and which database. But we have a pretty good understanding, and of course this is relatively easily measured. So far there's been several observations of these broad to narrow components. Tycho has a measurement, 1006, and then these other two remnants. And for example, why this is important is that if you can just measure the intensity of the broad component, that's going to depend on the neutral fraction, so how many neutrals are there. So this will tell you if, say, you've had a precursor come and ionize things, heat things up and actually ionize your ISM or CSM, if you've had a UV flash, if you've actually created some type of ionization state or not. And the actual ratio also tells you about the sharing of the of heat between the ion and electron the ions and electrons, and they are pretty much known in kind of the younger supernovas not to be equilibrated at all. The protons share much more energy or have much more energy than the electrons. And the neutral fraction also affects other diagnostics such as helium, helium lines, and also, again, to create this precursor. And by a precursor, basically I mean that these neutrals somehow can get upstream of the shock and heat it, and then once the shock comes, it's coming into a different regime than the ambient stellar interstellar medium. So what I did is I took a Monte Carlo model and tried to run this and try to understand how these neutrals go through the shock and vary things such as temperature and density, so I can control everything upstream and I can initially set everything downstream in terms of temperatures, densities, and velocities, and run a shock through it and see how far I can get. So I vary things from a neutral fraction of less than 1% to around 90%. Now, 90% is actually unphysical because you'd have mass-loaded shock, but I did it anyway. And the magnetic orientation is another variable because this this depends on how easily a proton can go back and forth up and down the shock, because the magnetic orientation, if you are at 90 degrees to the shock normal, you actually can just fly back and forth along that magnetic field. But if you're an ion and you're 90 degrees, you can't as easily cross the shock. I also varied shock speed from 300 to 3,000 kilometers per second. So taking into account anything from a Cygnus loop type old remnant at 300 to near 3,000, which is what 1006 is at. And then I also varied the amount of equilibration between the electrons and protons from being little, having no only almost no at 0.1 equilibrium to 0.9. This is a setup of those parameters in terms of slow neutrals, broad neutrals, and the protons and electrons. And this is the number density versus the distance away from the shock. So this is what the neutrals would see as they're going through the shock. They already have some type of number density of slow neutrals versus versus protons. So took some atomic interaction data. Also did something that was currently stylish at the time. It was lower hybrid wave heating. So what happens with this wave is that first the electrons kind of get excited in a wave surf, and then they transfer their energy to protons via Coulomb collision. And looking for this, one of the things that this could do is possibly create the precursor. So first I got the predicted broad to narrow ratios, and this is for an alpha of 0.5, so there's half as much temperature of the electrons in the electrons than in the protons. And there's a large variation, as you can see, versus shock speed versus the broad to narrow ratio. And this is actually only a parallel shock, because there is more variance in a parallel shock than the perpendicular shock is. You'd have much smaller changes. And shocks, and also neutral fraction doesn't actually change this much. So it's much more highly dependent on shock speed and this alpha than the neutral fraction. And one neat thing that came out of this is that I used the measured broad to narrow ratios from previous results, and then tried to predict the magnetic angle of the shock, since the magnetic angle actually varies this a lot. And so for a measurement from 1006 of 0.73 and this almost 3,000 kilometers per second shock speed, we actually figured out that it was a parallel shock model, which does fit the predicted data. And again, the code kind of matches all of these, but there's a wide window, so the next step is to actually do some other modifications so I can narrow those down. And so we looked at precursor heating, and it seems to, here's the shock speed versus how much relative heating each shock or each run gave me. And it's highly dependent on shock speed and neutral fraction. However, there was only about a 60 Kelvin increase versus the mega Kelvin temperatures that are in the shock front. So there's basically no effect at the shock area. And the other thing about it is that the precursor only extends one mean free path beyond the shock. So you're not going to be able to see this very far ahead, or see this effect very far ahead of the shock. So there's virtually just no way that the neutrals are a strong precursor. And the broad to narrow intensity ratios are, again, highly velocity and temperature dependent. And then they also decrease, they have a decreased effect with increased shock velocity. And this is also, this could easily be exchanged by this fall off of the charge exchange cross section with increasing shock speed. And that was seen in Hengen McRae, who did a recent simulation of all of this. So now I'm going to switch to the observations and trying to look more at the structure than what I was looking at before was the density and the neutral fraction. And this is the H alpha observation that was recently done in the paper that Raymond had also submitted recently. And what we knew from past observations is that this should be all thermal and X-rays. It's a relatively low density. There are ejector knots that are about right here. and those have been observed in the X-rays. And so what we're looking at not here is the broad to narrow ratio as much, but actually just how this is rippled. There's some very nice ripples here, and there's a big ripple that looks like an S over here. And we were looking at how wide this this section actually is. So again, it's not that this is the intensive, the...
Can you orient me? Maybe I'm...
Okay. This is the center of the remnant. So this is, this is 1006.
And the X-ray, was this the one you showed at the beginning with the X-ray?
Right, yeah. With the X-ray, it's over here in this corner.
So. Do you have an X-ray?
This one. So this is the knot right here. So yeah, so that's, and so we're up in this region for the filament. We cut off just before that. So there's that region.
And what was known, the H alpha was known first.
Right, yeah, the X-rays came later, but Okay, yes. So this is just a distance scale, length scale, versus the intensity. And so for one of the positions, positions 10, which is in this this thin area right here, we have some type of broadness based on the fact that the thickness of this emitted reading region should be proportional to one over the pre-shock density. And these are model runs as to trying to fit how this should fall off would tell you how the pre-shock density also changes. And we find that, 1, 2, 3, it's the density is around 0.25, which is what we thought originally, and that the neutral fraction is about 0.3, which seems to hold together with other observations. So what we've also learned from this is that the radius of curvature of those little ripples that you see are much less than the length of the filament. So there's some type of structure, underlying structure from the ISM. And the filament length itself is about 7 arcminutes, about 4 parsecs long, and that's 100 times the ripple length. So these ripples can just be accounted for by regular ISM turbulence, but what I think is more important is that the amplitudes of the ripples are not consistent with just a Kolmogorov spectra of fluctuation, and it's much higher amplitude. So you can imagine that it's something that hasn't relaxed completely, that there's actually an increase in density along these lines of sight. And the fact that the narrow component isn't very wide means that there's no room for precursors. There's nothing that's in this picture telling you that, oh, look, there's a large amount of emission here for a precursor, because this is that you can actually see, I think there's stars that are here and here. So there's actually no room for precursors. So it's pretty much ruled out that neutrals are a precursor here. So the supernova, the Balmer filaments, I think what they give us a clue for are the Balmer width and the structure leads to the structures of the ISM or the CSM surrounding the explosion. And when you're looking at the temperatures and densities of the ISM, that's going to tell you how much energy is deposited pre-explosion. It also tells you a little bit about the dynamics of the actual then propagation of the ejecta, well, not ejecta, but of the shock through the ISM. So that's all I could find that was related to supernovas in terms of supernova Balmer remnants. Questions? Comments? I was trying not to be as controversial as Carl.
this gas has to be neutral.
Yes.
And people have talked about progenitors of type 1A supernovae as being X-ray sources.
Right.
What limits on the photoionization of the surround do you get from the presence of neutral filaments so close to the
Right. I know that Parviz has done work that says basically that a UV flash could not go out. I am not sure about X-ray energies, but I know there's no UV energy photoionization present in 1006. But Go ahead.
The thing with SN1006 is it's 30 arcminutes across. It's huge in parallel density. So the constraints that you would get from the fact that there is a Balmer filament there are
much
different from the ones you would get.
Tycho.
Recombination time is long, but it's good. It means if this thing was a super soft source, which it's would still be really good at photoionization.
Right.
So that's easy enough to check, right? So that's been done. Saul Rappaport, and the name of Warren, you involved in that? So Saul Rappaport and Eugene Chen's undergraduate work was on calculating the photoionization schedule around super soft sources. So easy enough to display
that over
size scale to see.
Yep, lower the density, the less photoionization it has. In fact, that's the only one other super soft source. Locally, there are about a dozen, maybe, depending on what your definition is, you might say 18 sources.
Right.
They've all been searched for nebulae, but there's only one, and that is Kelly-3. Certainly, you're absolutely right. It would be ionized if you had the X-ray source there for a long time. And the nice thing that Eugene and Paul found in this is that the ionization nebulae are huge. So you're talking about something that can be 10 parsecs or more in extent. So it's not at all a bad idea. In fact, it would be very nice to check. And the fact that you don't find it is actually consistent with the fact that as far as I can see, the numbers of super soft sources we find in galaxies is far smaller than the number of progenitor systems that must be actively accreting today. So that's not to say that the white dwarf model isn't happening exactly as Ed and other people have developed it, but we're not seeing the soft X-rays from it. So something must be happening around that system that is shielding it. And you're thinking of another line of evidence that may be telling me the same thing.
Thanks, Lynn. You guys all know the center cost to Doug, right? Doug, you can't do
this. You have another question?
Sure, well, I had a comment, a question, and a suggestion about a lack of
work. Okay, well,
Well, they're two separate.
Yes, they're
okay.
Two separate.